This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And a little bit later, you'll be joined by Will Bentley. In this week's show, we are covering the new films Whitetail, Potter's Ground, and The Ghosts of Bawley Rectory. Our short shot is Yellow Belt Fury, and the throwback is Tiger House. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review this week is Whitetail. Shortly after the death of his mother, autistic Donnie is taken on his first hunting trip with his distant dad and his uncle Frank. However, any attempt at bonding is cast aside when they discover a wounded man in the forest carrying a bag of money. Now, I'm going to be a little bit unfair here, Steve, because I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you a question now, which I'm not going to ask you later on when we cover the other films. What is the point of this film?
I think it's to drag it out as much as fucking possible, to be fair.
This is half an hour too long for this material, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Just for starters, yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I put it on and it said, like, you know, 2 hours, 10 minutes. Oh, shit, here we go. To be fair.
Yeah, there's nothing here to justify it at all.
No, not really. It's your kind of... It's a bit like, you know, No Country for Old Men, but...
Yeah, exactly. Or A Simple Plan, as it was the other one that came to mind.
Yeah.
Sam Raimi.
Yeah. But, you know, set in, like, one location on this ranch, I presume, you know, like, farmland, whatever it is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, farmland or something.
But, yeah, I thought it was very dragged out. A lot of the dialogue was a bit strange as well.
Mm.
Especially when they find the guy with the... you know, the shot guy in the forest, and I don't know, it was like, you know, you can obviously see he's a criminal, but he's coming out of all his preachy Bible stuff, and it didn't really settle with me. And it was very, very slow. I mean, it was at a snail's pace, even when there was a bit of, you know, a bit of gore, a bit of action, it just seemed very, very slow. But one thing I will give it credit for, with the autistic lad, Donnie. Now, when he's being threatened and stuff, and he won't look the guy in the eyes.
Yeah.
You know, that to me, that was great how they brought that up, because a lot of people don't recognize that with autism. Mm. You know, the eye contact thing. Well, I don't know about, obviously not everyone on the spectrum, but my son, that's a very, very big thing for him. And I thought they got that just right. They got that perfect. You know what I mean? That was very good. The performances were good as well. But it was just too dragged out, too slow, but shot nicely as well. I thought the actual shooting was good. But yeah, you're right. What was the point? You know, it didn't...
It's a misery fest, you know. It's one of those. Yeah, it's one of those sort of misery fest kind of films. It started out okay, you know, because it starts out with that, well, the after effects of this sort of car crash, which I thought was nice. And I was worried it was going to turn out to be like in media res, and these two, because going into the film, you didn't know anything about this whatsoever. So, you know, I'm watching this, I'm thinking, well, there's a car crash already, and this guy, you know, these got one's escaping, one's chasing. I'm thinking, is this going to suddenly go 1 week earlier? You know, and I thought, oh, but no, it didn't. You know, to its credit, it wasn't that. It was something completely different. When it wanted to, it could be quite tense. That, you know, that whole thing at the trailer park with was it Richie? The brother. I thought that scene was really good, especially when you know, he's just about to leave and then he notices the backpack, and it sort of becomes, you know, sort of wrenches up the tension again. So yeah, it did have its moments, but
yeah, I mean,
yeah, for a long time, I wasn't clear that the sort of cowboy guy was actually Donnie's dad, because he was so distant. I thought both his parents had died, and there was his uncle sort of taking him out or something.
Right, okay.
You know, his uncle Frank, and this other guy was a friend or something. But yeah, it took a long time before we realised, oh, he's his dad, right? You know, because I think what the film was trying to address was, you know, Donnie is on the autistic spectrum, finds it difficult to relate to people, to talk to people. But at the same time, his dad is basically the same, you know, but of his own making sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, because it was saying that the mother had died about a month earlier of a drug overdose.
Yeah.
So I think it was kind of like, is it trying to show that his dad's blaming the kid, you know, for the struggles maybe, and that's what's pushed her over the edge. I think it was kind of throwing that vibe about, but.
But Frank sort of throws that in his face, doesn't he? He's sort of saying, well, you're the one who wasn't actually there. But I think part of it was, you know, the fact that his dad just cannot connect either, you know. But I think they fumbled that completely. But, there's some interesting bits here.
If I remember rightly, but it's just too long.
It is way too long.
Far too long.
Yeah. But there's not really a lot more you can say about it. It is quite a sort of threadbare story. You know, a few sort of confrontations and a lot of walking.
Well, that's, I mean, it's like we'll have a Mexican standoff, then we'll have a bit of a walk, then we'll have another Mexican standoff, then we'll have another bit of walk, another Mexican standoff. You know, it's just kind of like that all the way through.
It was. So anyway, I mean, I don't think we can sort of really dwell much on this one. It's not a bad, as you said, it's not badly made or anything, but it's just way too long. So what are you going to score it?
I'll give it a 6.
I believe that is totally fair. Like I said, when it does raise the pulse, it does so quite nicely. But, you know, and the thing is, you know, you can see, because the way the film moves its pieces around, you know, the audience is fully aware of where everyone is.
Yeah,
and you're just and you're just kind of waiting, you know, so, you know, it's like, oh, let's go back to Daryl's place. And that, yeah, but that guy's waiting at Daryl's place. it's not good. But then, then you have to wait while they... It's almost like it's in real time, you know. They've been working to Daryl's place. It's like, oh God, come on, hurry up. Anyway, never mind. I was a little bit distressed at the end because I'm thinking, what happens to Donnie? But I kind of think he'll be all right. Yeah, he'll be fine.
Yeah.
So that is two sixes for Whitetail. Go check it out. Our next review is Potter's Ground. A former Confederate marauder tries to make a clean start on a Texas dirt farm with his wife and young daughter. However, he quickly learns that sometimes the past just won't stay buried. Now, when I read the synopsis for this and I saw the words American Civil War, my heart went cold. You know, I was like, oh no, not again. Because I loved the last, I loved the last one that we had to cover, which luckily I've forgotten the name of. But
no, I don't think I was on that week.
Yeah, you probably, that was bad. But anyway, this was awesome. I thoroughly enjoyed this. This is a real sort of mashup between a sort of a Western and a sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I say Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I think The Mummy would probably be a closer match, especially The Mummy 3, the one with Jet Li in it. because there's this absolutely whacked out sequence where they get attacked by werewolves, and it's never mentioned again in the film.
Yeah, well,
it happens about halfway through the film, and it's like, oh, okay. And nobody goes, is anyone going to talk about the bloody werewolves? It doesn't happen. But I thoroughly enjoyed this. From its opening shot, I thought this is going to be something a little bit different, because, you know, because the first thing you see is the guy sort of stroking his dead dog on the prairie. And there's hints of, you know, weird shit going on, but it's sort of pushed to the back for a lot of the film. But I thought the script was really good. I thought the, you know, the dialogue, especially between the characters, was great. You know, had its sort of tongue just about in its cheek. Monster effects, especially the one at the end, was, I think that's where the money was missing, really. Mm. But I thought this was just good pulpy fun all the way through. I really enjoyed it. How about yourself?
I'm not as strong on it as you were, to be fair. It was all right. I enjoyed it, but it was kind of like, what was it called? The other week, Night Drive, was it?
Hmm. You think it was just like the twist came too far out of left field?
No, and like you said, it's never mentioned again.
Yeah.
You know, there's werewolves just turn up.
Hmm.
And that's it. And I don't know. It was like they didn't know which way to go. They've got like this Western type adventure, like say mummy / indie thing, with little niggles of like horror that could be there. Like, you know, they keep mentioning these creatures at wherever they're heading to and all this lot, and now one of them ran away from them and everything. But it doesn't go there.
No, it sort of skips that bit, doesn't it? Well, it sort of basically says, oh, it was all a pile of bollocks. Anyway.
Yeah. but you've got werewolves showing up for one scene, not mentioned, like, oh, shit, what the fuck, that's a werewolf. Mm. No, it's just, oh, yeah, it's a werewolf, okay. And then the ending, again, that just, again, came out of nowhere. And it's like, what?
Because yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, well, hang on a minute. I'll commend it. We'll just chuck this in.
The weird thing is, because of the structure of the film, you know, it starts in the brackets present, i.e., you know, 1871, and then jumps back 6 years, so where these three guys were part of a group of what they're called the Lone Wolves or something, or the they're these marauders working for the South who were given sort of carte blanche to just basically go out and cause mayhem and you know, as much as possible to sort of try and forward their cause. So, you know, we have this confrontation. And then we sort of basically, the bulk of the film is this long flashback to this mission that they were on. And I was kind of by that halfway point, I was expecting the ending to have some sort of supernatural thing. I thought it was going to be Potter sort of turning into a werewolf or something like that, you know. But well,
that's what I mean. There's little hints, little niggles, but it just doesn't come to fruition, and that's what kind of annoyed me.
Hmm.
You know, like I say, it's like they can't decide how they're going to, which way it's going to go. Are they going to go full on horror or not? Or they're just going to have it like you say, I suppose it is like indie, you know, because you get the adventure, but you get bits of horror, you know, like the heart ripping in Temple of Doom or the faces melting in Raiders and stuff like that. But that came from the story. The other, it didn't in this. But, you know, like I said, I thought the performances were great. The script was good. The way it was shot, I thought some of it was absolutely beautiful, especially when you get to, you know, where that
tomb sort of thing. Yeah.
Like the lead up to that was great. And especially the Mexican woman. I thought she was really good.
Yeah, she was.
I can't remember her name now. I've got it on here somewhere. Catherine Franco. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought she was really good. All in all, yeah, it's enjoyable, but it's just, again, like Night Driver, it frustrated me.
I think that, you know, this is one of those films that had chapter cards, which is something I don't tend to like. But I wish they just had one at the beginning which said, look, just go with it. Just go with it. Don't think about it too hard. But yeah, there's some really witty one-liners in it. So, you know, the sergeant guy was a total bit of a psycho. You know, when they're sort of about to go into the tomb and there's all these weird noises and shit, and somebody goes, do you think we should evacuate? And he goes, I think I just did. Which I thought was really cool. There's some really good lines like that. This was actually originally a short film. They'd done the short film and, you know, then blew it up. So the short is actually the opening sequence and the end sequence that's all in present day.
Okay, yeah.
With different actors. But the script is almost identical for that. And weirdly enough, the special effect at the end with the tentacles actually looks better in the short than it does in the finished film. But yeah, no, it's great to see, you know, that sort of thing where a short film is actually sort of blown up into a full feature and works in this particular way. I thoroughly enjoy this, as I said. I'm giving this, believe it or not, an 8 out of 10. How about yourself?
I'm gonna go with 6.
Okay, a 6 and an 8 for Potter's Ground. Go check it out. Our next review is The Ghosts of Bawley Rectory. The infamous spiritualist Harry Price is granted permission to conduct a 6-month study of Bawley Rectory, reported to be the most haunted place in England. So we're in very low budget territory here, and clearly there is a bit of an influence by the Conjuring style films. Harry Price is a real life figure, a very controversial one in the realm of the supernatural and sort of people who investigate that sort of thing. You know, allegedly he's a bit of a charlatan. He did actually go to Bawley Rectory and did conduct some, you know, research, and he did record a lot of poltergeist activity, which was totally the opposite kind of haunting that was being reported before he got there. And apparently, you know, once he left, all of that sort of stuff just stopped. So you can sort of, kind of weird that would happen, you know. But but this particular Harry Price, he's not painted in that way. He's, you know, he's a gentleman. He believes in science, and is keen to, you know, prove that something is actually going on and to actually record it. We've got a very good cast. You know, in smaller roles, we've got Colin Baker and Julian Sands, and also Toya Wilcox turns up as a spiritualist as well, so that's pretty cool. But how did you? Yes, very unrecognizable. You know, I'd noticed on IMDb that her name was in there, and then forgot about it. And then after the film, I looked again, and it's like, who was she again? But yeah, she's pretty good in this as well. So Will, let's go straight over to you then. What are your thoughts on this film?
On the whole, I liked it, but I'm an easy win because I'm a horror movie nut. Basically, I'm a big fan, and I mean, I love, like you say, it does kind of nod towards The Conjuring. It's actually a really good story. I think I didn't. I mean, you know, I'm not. I wasn't aware particularly of Harry Price's reputation and the fact that you know. The real story seems to be a little bit more hocus pocus than the real thing,
which is another it's another thing it's got in common with The Conjuring.
So yeah, But I mean, it's a really good story, and it's like it's really well crafted, and it really does improve. Like as you're watching it, as things warm up, you know, it just gets better and better. And I had no problem at all watching this. You know, you say, yeah, I mean, it's low budget, and it is quite a kind of ambitious. Not in terms of like effects or anything. I mean, it's ambitious in terms of the story it's trying to tell. And I think it handles it sort of really quite well, but it's not without its problems. I mean, it's a bit weird in some
ways. Yeah, I think it is a bit unfocused as to exactly what it's trying to portray. I mean, you're right, I'm with you. One of the things I really do like, sort of in the horror genre, is this sort of situation of like paranormal investigators, you know, suddenly being faced with actual paranormal activity, and they can't explain it. You know, they can't sort of like just explain away, you know, with science. It's like, you know, the face of it. I love stuff like that. It's one of my little things. I did like that sort of little vignettes that we get of, you know, sort of Julian Sands telling his story of what, you know, what he saw, and the stuff that starts happening. I think one of the problems is the focus is on this nun, this sort of ghostly nun in the thing, which again, heavily influenced by, you know, one of the Conjuring films or one of the Conjuring spirit spin-offs. But it doesn't give any background as to who she is or why she's carrying a big ass knife and stabbing people in their dreams. Which just seems really weird. It's like, okay, it's a nun. Why is she killing people?
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
And it doesn't answer those questions at all. And there is like a really weird reveal at the end. Like in the very last bit, which is just so strange because it's a brilliant reveal and it's a brilliant kind of denouement for what's happened. And, you know, especially with how it affects Price, and you see how much, you know, he's got invested because his performance, who's the actor? It's not fair on the other cast, but he really does hold it together.
He does, well. Toby Wynn Davis is his name.
But that final denouement is almost like it could be from a different story.
Yes. Absolutely. As I said, yeah, Julian Sands, funny enough, we were just talking about him on one of the other shows we did recently, because he turns up in The Survivalist with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. So it's great to sort of, you know, see him again. You know, I've been a fan of his ever since Warlock with...
original Warlock, 1980s Warlock.
Yeah, with Richard E. Grant. Brilliant film. And the sequel turned out to be really good as well. Actually, the first sequel, at least. I haven't seen the second one. But, always great to see him. And, you know, Colin Baker is my least favourite Doctor. But, again, it's still good to see him on screen. In this one, he plays a newspaper owner who, you know, is looking to get the rights to whatever evidence Harry sort of comes up with in his experiments. But yeah, so the scares themselves, or you know, these haunting bits, the thing with the nun is done really well, I thought. You know, the costume, the sort of CGI sort of makeup effects work really well. It's quite happy with that. I think what I would have liked to have seen or heard is more use of sort of the sound spectrum. Because, you know, clearly they don't have a big budget, but, you know, I think some good sort of sound effects can go a long way in this sort of film.
The voice effects that they used for the, you know, for the spooky bits were brilliant. And, you know, like when just those sort of odd bits where people, were answering in the, you know, in the wrong voice stuff. I thought were brilliantly done.
And yeah, like during the seance and things. Yeah.
Yeah, and even just in when people waking up having nightmares, and yeah, you know, I think it was the, I think you're right. They underutilized what you can do with great sound. It was really subtle, and I mean, I tend to notice, you know, good soundscapes and stuff like that. And I mean, everyone notices terrible ones. Like, I think you reviewed something recently which had the most incongruous kind of soundtrack, and then it really kind of jars. But this didn't, and it you bang on the money with it, really, because they could have really emphasized and done a lot more with it, and it would have made all of their scares and stuff like a lot more punchy.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, some of the scares are effective. Some of those dream sequences work really well. My favorite one is when one of the characters he sees something and he's like, oh, he sort of, you know, bolt upright in bed, and then he just goes back to sleep. he just lies straight back down, and then there's another scare. But I just thought that was hilarious. It's like, yeah, I'm just scared. It's like, never mind, I'll go back to sleep.
you wouldn't you'd be like, and you'd be going home, you'd be like, no, stop it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, again, to its credit, you know, there is a character, Roger, who's sort of the son of the person who currently is leasing the estate. He does get shit scared and leaves.
Yeah,
it's sort of halfway through, which is quite amusing. His sister, who's sort of, you know, the more buxom one, who's also a spiritualist. Yeah. I thought she was actually really good in this. I think it's one of her earlier roles. I'm just going to double check. Louisa Warren
is the name.
Yeah, I thought she did really well. Yeah, exactly. No, she's been around for donkeys. So I say donkeys, I mean, she's, you know, been putting in a lot of work.
Yeah.
So good on her, basically. There are a couple of weird things in this. The opening credit sequence is missing the credits, which is really bizarre. So we get this sort of montage of stuff, you know.
Together at all.
With no actual credits rolling across the top of them. So it just seems like a really weird introduction to the film. And it also commits the crime of utilizing footage from the film itself in the opening credits, which is something...
Yeah, that's just cheap, isn't it? Really,
it's pretty bad, yeah. I mean, I haven't actually seen that done since there was a Jean-Claude Van Damme film called Kill 'Em All, which came out about 5 years ago. Which was one of his worst films, and that did exactly the same thing. You know, let's have a beefy opening credit sequence using clips of the action scenes from the film you're about to watch. I mean, that is cheap.
I don't get it as a creative choice. I really don't. I mean, you know, so much kind of effort goes into sort of, you know, pacing a film and putting stuff like that in it, and all you do when you kind of show half of it in the title sequences, I just think it confuses the narrative that you're trying to tell, and it's almost like you don't trust the film to kind of, you're still thinking people might walk out while the title sequence is playing. You know, better paste a load of stuff in there to make sure
it's the worst kind of in media res. Yeah, now to be fair, again, you know, just for balance, I will point out that the Mission Impossible series has always done this as well. Shame on you, Tom Cruise. You know, it does annoy me sitting down to watch a Tom Cruise, you know, just sitting down to watch a Mission Impossible movie, and it's showing me all the stuff which is going to be happening in the film, because obviously that's what used to happen in the TV show, you know, in this episode.
Yeah, but like, that's still no reason. When was that series made again?
The series back in the 60s. Yeah,
exactly. Things have moved on.
Exactly. But anyway, we digress. I'm just trying to think if there is anything else. Yeah, so the idea of the film is that, you know, yes, it's haunted. There's loads of ghosts and things knocking around, but there is this sort of one big bad, basically, who's sort of keeping all the ghosts from passing on, and that's who they're trying to contact. But I think that's where it starts to get a bit murky, you know, with the second seance and everything. Unfortunately, that's where the sort of narrative starts to get a bit strange and a bit sort of lost. But other than that, the other good thing as well, is that it kind of jumps forward a bit, and then you get sort of, you know, Harry Bryce sort of talking about what happened, and you know, the conclusions are inconclusive.
Yeah,
basically, you know, which I thought was pretty good. You know, I thought that was quite interesting as well, that they didn't sort of go, ah, yeah, definitely. You know, we can say because, without a shadow of doubt, there's ghosts or something. It's like, no.
Yeah, but you can't, because you're talking about a, you know, a folklore kind of staple in British kind of supernatural culture and history. You know, you can't. It'd be like making a film out of the Loch Ness Monster, you know, set in, because it's set between the wars, isn't it? It's set,
yeah, kind of, that's right. Yeah.
Like late 30s.
Yeah, and I think it burned down and sort of, yeah, during the
40s. Well, yeah, exactly. Just, I think during or.
Yeah, sort of during or just after
the Second World War. So it'd be like making a film about the Loch Ness Monster, where in the 1940s, someone manages to, you know, fish the monster out of the lock and everyone sees it. Well, that kind of didn't happen. So do you know what I mean? You can't suddenly sort of solve the mystery of Borley Rectory, because it was never solved, and it's still there as a staple in British kind of ghost hunting folklore history, because you can still go there and, you know, try and see the ghost.
Well, yeah, I mean, the village of Borley, which is in Essex, I mean, it is a creepy place, basically. You know, I went there once. And there is a sort of small church there, and I went in there, and it was in the middle of the daytime, yeah, on a Saturday, basically. And even so, you know, you do just get a weird vibe coming from it. In fact, my mum was with me, and she left. she went in there. It goes, I'm like, I can't stay. And she's like the most religious person I know. Yeah,
blimey, right, yeah. Okay, so it really is in the bones of the
I had a friend of mine who said he went there and he saw the ghost of a centurion, you know, Roman centurion or something. I think he's full of shit, but you know, it's that sort of thing that, you know,
people, yeah, but this is because it is like the best folklore tale in that it's grown over the decades and centuries, and that people, you know, are always saying, oh, it's so haunted. There's ghosts going back to Roman times, and, you know, there's not just the kind of Victorian, you know, person in a long dress or whatever. There's loads of, you know, every year there's sort of more added to it, which, you know, it doesn't do any harm for Borley as a kind of, you know, occult sort of destination for people who are into that kind of thing. It's like how Bram Stoker's Dracula makes Whitby, the town of Whitby, a fortune every year, because, you know, people go up there and,
yeah,
did the pilgrimage to Carfax Abbey and all the rest of it. So, you know, it's like, well, you know, why not? I mean, but like I said, it kind of does limit, if you want your film to sort of, you know, to be taken seriously, so to speak, it kind of limits what you're going to do. So you can't really have some denouement where they kind of catch all the ghosts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is directed by a guy called Stephen M. Smith. Now, this is a guy who gives the word prolific a bad name, because he must be one of the most busiest people in the film industry. You know, this year alone, by the end of this year, he'd have directed 5 films.
Wow. I know. Coming out of lockdown, that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty impressive, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Dead Again, POV, Ghost Hosts, The Ghosts of Borley Rectory, Dr. Pym and The Test. And then he's got a documentary series slated for next year. He basically started off doing the Essex Boys and the sort of hooligan kind of movies.
Have we reviewed any of his of these?
Not of those ones. There are a couple I do want to actually see. One's called Hooligans at War. No, not that one. Where was it? Just bear me 2 seconds. There is one of the hooligan ones. Red Army Hooligans, that's it. Where, you know, these football hooligan guys go to Russia for a football match and end up getting kidnapped by Russian hooligans, basically.
Okay.
Which sounds like a nightmare. Yeah, but he's sort of, you know, he seems to have sort of graduated from those sort of style films to the sort of cheap and cheerful horror stuff. A lot of stuff for Haunted Dolls.
thing. Yeah, people love that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, you know, good for him. And like, really, this is, you say graduated. This is, I mean, for all of it, you know, there are things with it that mean that it's clearly and visibly not a had loads of money chucked at it Hollywood blockbuster. This is a really mature effort.
Oh, definitely. And the thing is, as well, he actually directed another film about Borley Rectory 2 years ago, which we covered on this show. Me and Rich and Steve covered it. It wasn't as good as this. It was even cheaper. It was, you know, the film stock quality, you know, the video stock quality was a lot less quality than this as well. This is a much better production, which I can almost see why he wanted to do it again, you know. Now, the thing is, even so, it was a very sort of cheap, not particularly well-made film. It still had something, you know, we didn't sort of write it off completely. And also, you know, Rich keeps track of the DTV chart each week. So there's an official top 100 DVD releases each week. And we sort of work out which ones of those are, you know, DTV, director video, as it were. And the previous Borley Rectory film that he made stayed in that top 100 for something like 25 weeks.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, it had staying power. And that is the power of the name of Borley Rectory, you know, in horror circles, basically. People.
You've got to anticipate good things for this one, then.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is definitely a step up. And you know, with a bit more of a name cast to it, I reckon this will, well, time will tell, but I reckon this one will stick around.
Did you spot a well-known, well-loved British TV soap character actor in the ranks as well?
Well, other than Colin Baker, you mean? And Julian Sands? No, who? Was it the guy playing the farmer guy?
Yeah, D.I. Burnside from The Bill.
Oh shit!
Yeah,
he was really good as well, and he had a great scene. You know, when he turns up and he's complaining about the bells and everything, and everyone's going,
"Yeah,
bells? We're not really bells." Yeah, I thought that was a really good scene as well.
Yeah.
All right, that was Burnside, was it? Shit.
Yeah, man. Could recognise him, could you? With his like full-on country boy accent.
Yeah. No, I really like that bit. And you know, that's again, I kind of wish they did, you know, enlarge the scope a bit. You know, it would have been good to sort of see that sort of stuff rather than, you know, just be told about it afterwards. But there you go, budget same.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if he had a bit more money, you could see where he would be going and doing things, because that's exactly where you would, you know, you'd be like, you know, you can't, because you've just got some random coming up and saying, what was all that about? And you've not shown it. It's a bit like, yeah, it's not, I, to be honest with you, you would, if you had the money, you'd be showing it. But having said that, there's a bit where Price is telling the story of what happened to, oh, what was the name, the lady?
He
recounts the story.
While he's asleep. Was that
he's telling the other people, oh yes, and this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is what she sort of told to me. And telling a story, especially when the acting's as good as that, has its own currency in it within a film.
Oh yeah.
And it was brilliant, you know, and it was kind of brilliantly done, even though it was minimal sort of visuals. You know, really, for, you know, because they did sort of like have a little bit of, you know, what did she see, what was going on, sort of thing.
There is a really weird bit though, where I think it's Harry Price is asleep and he's telling the story of somebody else, which is it's really weird the way it's done. You know, you get his voiceover explaining somebody else's story while he's asleep,
and then because it's all a dream.
It's very strange, but yeah. Okay, so how are we going to score The Ghost of Borley Rectory?
it's got to be a solid. It's a solid 8 from me, to be honest with you. I mean, I'd probably 8.5.
That's very good indeed. I'm not as generous on this one, but I did enjoy it. I think one of the, you know, one of my sort of benchmarks is whether or not I felt compelled to skip through scenes. You know, watching these things on laptops and stuff, and the, you know, the temptation is there just to go, all right, this is going nowhere. What's happening next? You know, sort of skip forward a bit. But I found myself not doing that with this. I did sort of watch the whole thing. I did think it was a bit stagey at the beginning. You know, it was almost as if it was a play. The way the lines were being delivered.
I wanted to talk about that. Like, I know we've kind of run out of time and we're scoring.
That's already, right.
It had to warm up. It warmed up a lot more. The dialogue warmed up and flowed a lot more and was a lot more natural. It's almost like you're thinking, did they shoot this in more or less chronological order? And everyone kind
possibly,
of got there. Everyone got their kind of.
They found their place and sort of got into the characters a bit more. Yeah, quite possibly. So I think it did take a little while to feel like a film and not an adaptation of a play. But, you know, once that sort of first night starts to hit and, you know, it allowed the sort of supernatural stuff to come into it, it did work a lot better. So I did enjoy it, which would give it a 6. The question is, would I? Yeah, I would. I'd watch it again. So that would push it up to a 7. So there you go. So a 7 and an 8 for The Ghost of Bawley Rectory. Go check it out. Our short shot this week is Yellow Belt Fury. When aliens murder her husband, a young woman enrolls in the local karate school to learn how to kick alien butt. Nice and short this one, Steve. How did you get on with this?
Sorry, mate. Cut out then. Sorry, technical problems. It went off. Sorry. This is actually quite fun, this one. Starts off a little weird. Because I was actually watching it on TV and the wife was there. She actually thought it was a waffle advert at first.
I thought it was, because it's on YouTube and YouTube has got a habit now of like throwing adverts at the beginning, in the middle, in the end. And I thought, okay, this is the advert before the short starts, but and it goes straight into it. It's cool.
Yeah. But that's, you know, it is that kind of zany, action-y type thing that's going on, and you know, there's no real alien threat there. It's just the husband walks out and next thing is mincemeat, really. But you don't see any of that. You just see her covered in blood, and then she wants to train at a dojo to fight the aliens, and it turns out that a teacher is an alien.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a bit of a fight and that's it. But it's short, snappy, fun, well shot. You know, I actually really enjoyed this one. It was really good.
Yeah, Rich, you curated this for us as usual. Obviously, you must have liked this one.
Yeah, I liked how lively it is, and it's like you say, the zaniness is it covers a lot of ground in 5 minutes. So I quite like the initial setup. It's got that, you know, the quirky stuff with the waffles and the idyllic family life, you know, the idyllic couple, you know, the life is shattered, and, you know, the revenge kind of plot develops from that. So it's touching on lots of things that we're quite familiar with, but doing it in a course sort of really, you know, quirky kind of fashion. I like a lot of the editing, like it cuts at the beginning from her going, "Ooh, something just happened to my husband." So then suddenly she's outside covered in blood and whatever, and then there's a whole training montage with the martial arts and stuff. So it fills the time really well, and, you know, leads to a one-on-one finale with I don't know if you recognised her, but the sensei is Charlotte Tashin, who was the lead in the Cocktail Party short film that we watched at Fighting Spirit. Mm. And she co-wrote that one as well, but this one she's in just as sort of the antagonist of the piece. And the action is coordinated, choreographed by a guy called Alfred Singh, who's got quite a resume of shorts and things, including one that he directed himself called The Recruit, with an actress called Jennifer C. That's a fairly typical sort of fight short, that one. Mm-hmm. But he's all over the place doing lots of big budget stuff and everything. So this is quite a good little film for him. But it's really more about Catherine Hughes's film. It's her debut as a filmmaker. She's primarily known as an actress, and I think she's done a really good job.
I totally agree. As you say, this is her first time as a director, and she totally nails it.
It's very confident, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very confident. The editing's great. You get that sort of feeling, this couple are still in their honeymoon phase, you know, waffles in the morning and all the rest of it. Yeah, not just slinging a digestive at each other over a cup of coffee. Not yet. but yeah, it's fun. It's vibrant. The training montage is done really well. And what I was really glad as well is that she isn't sort of just handed a black belt after 5 minutes training. You know, is that, well, congratulations, you're one rung up on the ladder. You know, but it's just really, really well done. So yeah, more from Catherine Hughes, please, as a director, I think.
And the lead actress is Melanie Rains. I thought mm-hmm. she was really good.
Yes, she was. She captured it really well. And I do love that edit at the beginning when she sort of like goes, "Mark," and then it sort of cuts to her outside and say, just splat with blood. That was a really good bit of editing, that.
Searching for the film, that image, that thumbnail is kind of the defining sort of image of the film that comes up to sort of get your interest, even though it's got that martial arts element to it, but it's not just a martial arts thing. It's a combination of all these different elements makes it work really well.
Absolutely. So that is Yellow Belt Fury. We'll put the link in the footnotes as usual, and we do think you should go and check this out. Our DTV throwback this week is Tiger House. A young teen called Kelly sneaks into a bed. A young teen called Kelly sneaks into a boyfriend's house, but tonight she's not the only unwelcome visitor. As the situation spirals out of control, the suburban house becomes. Excuse me. Oh, bloody hell. I burped in the middle of that. I'll do the whole thing again. Our short shot this week is Yellow Belt Fury. When aliens murder her husband, a young woman enrolls in the local karate school to learn how to kick alien butt. Nice and short, this one, Steve. How did you get on with this?
Sorry, mate. Cut out then. Sorry, technical problems. It went off. Sorry. This is actually quite fun, this one. Starts off a little weird. Because I was actually watching it on TV and the wife was there. She actually thought it was a waffle advert at first.
I thought it was, because it's on YouTube, and YouTube has got a habit now of like throwing adverts at the beginning, in the middle, in the end. And I thought, okay, this is the advert before the short starts, but and it goes straight into it. It's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, but that's, it is that kind of zany, action-y type thing that's going on, and there's no real alien threat there. It's just the husband walks out and next thing he's mincemeat, really. But you don't see any of that. You just see her covered in blood, and then she wants to train at a dojo to fight the aliens, and it turns out that a teacher is an alien. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bit of a fight and that's it. But it's short, snappy, fun, well shot. I actually really enjoyed this one. It was really good.
Rich, you curated this for us as usual. Obviously, you must have liked this one.
Yeah, it's I liked how lively it is, and it's like you say, the zaniness is it covers a lot of ground in 5 minutes. So I quite like the initial setup. It's got that, you know, the quirky stuff with the waffles and the idyllic family life, you know, the idyllic couple, you know, life is shattered, and, you know, the revenge kind of plot develops from that. So it's touching on lots of things that we're quite familiar with, but doing it in a sort of really, you know, quirky kind of fashion. I like a lot of the editing, like it cuts at the beginning from her going, "Ooh, something just happened to my husband." So then suddenly she's outside covered in blood and whatever. And then there's a whole training montage with the martial arts and stuff. So it fills the time really well, and leads to a one-on-one finale with, I don't know if you recognized her, but the sensei is Charlotte Tashin, who was the lead in the Cocktail Party short film that we watched at Fighting Spirit. Mm. And she co-wrote that one as well. But this one, she's in just as sort of the antagonist of the piece. And the action is coordinated, choreographed by a guy called Alfred Singh, who's got quite a resume of shorts and things, including one that he directed himself called The Recruit, with an actress called Jennifer C. That's a fairly typical sort of fight short, that one. Mm-hmm. But he's all over the place doing lots of big budget stuff and everything. So this is quite a good little film for him. But it's really more about Catherine Hughes. It's Catherine Hughes's film. It's her debut as a filmmaker. She's primarily known as an actress, and I think she's done a really good job.
I totally agree. As you say, this is her first time as a director, and she totally nails it.
It's very confident, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very confident. The editing's great. You get that sort of feeling, you know, that this couple are still in their honeymoon phase, you know, you know, waffles in the morning and all the rest of it. Yeah, not just slinging a digester at each other over a cup of coffee, not yet. But yeah, it's fun. It's vibrant. But, you know, the training montage is done really well. And what I was really glad as well is that she isn't sort of just handed a black belt after 5 minutes training. You know, congratulations, you're one rung up on the ladder. You know. But it's just really, really well done. So, yeah, more from Catherine Hughes, please, as a director, I think.
And the lead actress is Melanie Rains. I thought she was really good.
Yeah, she was. She captured it really well. And I do love that edit at the beginning when she sort of like goes, "Mark," and then it sort of cuts to her outside and say, just splattered with blood. That was a really good bit of editing, that.
Searching for the film, that image, that thumbnail is kind of the defining sort of image of the film that comes up to sort of get your interest. Even though it's got that martial arts element to it, but it's not just a martial arts thing. It's a combination of all these different elements makes it work really well.
Absolutely. So that is Yellow Belt Fury. We'll put the link in the footnotes as usual, and we do think you should go and check this out. Our DTV throwback this week is Tiger House. A young woman called Kelly sneaks into her boyfriend's house late at night, but this time she's not the only unwelcome visitor. As the situation spirals out of control, the suburban house becomes a terrifying arena for violence. This is on Amazon Prime. I've had my eye on this one for a while, Steve, but let's hear what you think about this first.
It was all right. I'll be honest, I don't really like I can never pronounce it. Is it Scrine? Screen?
Screen? Yeah, let's go with Screen.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of his. I think he's, well, which is not very good, to be fair. Even in Deadpool, I thought it was a bit crap. But again, it's just, Kay Escodaro hiding under a bed and then jumping in an attic for a couple of hours. It just didn't excite me enough. I didn't think it was as like a house invasion film. I think there's been much better and more terrifying, more tension building films, to be fair, out there. This one, it just seemed quite a bit flat to me. And you've got Dougray Scott, who's, you know, probably the biggest name, really, at the time when it came out, just lying on a bed. You know, probably had him for a couple of days. We'll mock up a dummy for when he's supposed to pass out. And it just, yeah, and the final twist, saw that coming a mile off as well. You know, with it, who's involved in it.
Yeah, I'll go with you.
About, right, yeah. You know,
you could tell the way he was giving instructions. You know, because they're listening in over the sort of radio, and they can hear what he's telling them to do. You know, I think he's in on it. I totally agree that there are certainly better home invasion movies and movies like this. There was one with Harrison Ford and Paul Bettany. I can't remember what it was called now. I don't know, it's called Firewall.
Firewall.
A while ago. And even Scott Atkins has done one, which was okay. And he was the baddie in it. He was the main guy. The issue I really had with this was the fact that they put Dougray Scott out of commission right from the off. You know, he's supposed to be the mastermind of this this whole thing. And he has to do it all from the bed because he's got this huge shard of glass stuck in him because they hadn't counted on the sun on the sun actually having a pair of balls and trying to do something about the situation. I mean, and that is on these home invasion guys, because really they should have got him first. And if they had, they would have caught the girl straight away.
Yeah.
You know, but no, let's go get the guy. You know. It could, and I reckon that's probably because the guy had such a low opinion of his stepson. You think, you won't do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I thought the girl was good. Yeah. I thought the girl was good. You know, the opening bit with the crossbow and the fact that he's such a
Chekhov's crossbow.
Chekhov's crossbow. Yeah. Well, Chekhov's crossbow and Chekhov's crossbow bolt. Yeah. Funny enough, the thing we didn't mention in the Potter's Ground review was Chekhov's broken chair.
Because
that is set up right from the beginning, then you totally forget about it, and then you see it at the end and go, oh yeah, the chair's broken. But yes, Chekhov's crossbow, obviously that's going to be used. Can't find any bolts. Oh, it turns out that she's still got the bolt that he shot her with in her bag. Comes in useful. There is one really good stunt in this as well, where he has to jump out of a window and hold onto the ledge just as a fireball sort of hits the room. I thought that was really well done. I'm not a hater of Ed Skrein. I actually don't mind him at all. I've seen a lot of, you know, the first film I saw him in was Northlanders, which is a really, really good Viking action movie. I thoroughly enjoy that. And he was the baddie in that. And I even like the Transporter movie he did. I don't know if you've seen that one.
No, I haven't. I'll be honest, no. Actually, I've not seen it much, but I just don't really.
Well, the thing about the Transporter movie as well is that his dad is played by Ray Stevenson. In that Transporter movie, his dad is played by Ray Stevenson, and basically he's playing James Bond retired. It is a really brilliant performance. All he says is that he's a civil servant, but he is basically James Bond's recently retired from the service, and he gets all the women. It's just really, really funny. I quite like that. Anyway, but I digress. Dougray Scott, he's a good presence. You know, good to have him in the film, but wasted. Totally wasted, unfortunately.
But also, I think either the director's got a foot fetish or he's trying to be Tarantino as well, because the amount of women's feet in this film.
Yeah, all barefoot and everything.
It is ridiculous.
But yeah, I like the. Well, I don't say I liked it, but the class, the conflict between his mum and the girl, and, you know, she's from the wrong side of the tracks, darling. You shouldn't be involved in all this. I liked it. It's not the best thing, definitely, but you know, if you're scrolling through Amazon Prime, it's on there, and it's worth. Was it 90 minutes, 80 minutes long, I think? So, I there's certainly worse stuff out there you can try. So that is Tiger House. We don't score the DTV throwbacks, but we recommend them. Go check them out. So, yeah, Tiger House on Amazon Prime. And that is the end of this week's show. So thanks to Rich and Will and Steve, of course, for help covering these reviews.
No problem.
Don't forget to check out the DTV Digest sister show, the DTV Digest Short Shot, and also our Twitter and Facebook pages at the DTV Digest. Other than that, thank you for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.